Hey, everybody. Welcome to a special edition of, I don't know what this is, I guess, Dave and Daryl.
Addendum to the Friday filibuster.
Yeah, the addendum to the Friday filibuster. So, obviously, hopefully if you listened to our last Friday filibuster, which we felt was a pretty good one, there was me and Daryl just freestyling, talking about all manner of things from Jean-Claude Van Damme to Noah, which we've been talking Noah actually for a couple of weeks now. And now that we both have seen it, we thought it'd be cool just to sit down for like a half hour official Friday filibuster review slash debrief. Slash just let's get this all off our chest, because that's been a movie that Daryl and I have both been anticipating. I think we bring very different worldviews with us to it, so that we've talked about that as well, so I think that'll be interesting to see how that all shakes out. But I think something we definitely have in common is we respect the director a great deal, and we feel like there's plenty of room for legit Bible movie making. You know, that is not hokey, that is not corny. So I think, you know, so We were both angling for that out of this. So we're going to get right into it. So, again, our special half-hour Noah debrief. Daryl, you just saw it, right?
Yeah, I'm an hour out of the theater now.
So an hour out of the theater. And I saw it. I jumped on a 7 o'clock Thursday preview showing. And I actually brought my – this would be another interesting – I brought my parents who are, you know, who are – believers themselves and pretty, you know, sort of old school, but like movies a lot. So they had some interesting reactions as well. So we'll get a pretty good gamut, I think, of responses. But yeah, so I'm about, so I will say this. I know right before we hit record, you said you're an hour out. You're still reeling. I'm like 3 days and I'm still thinking about this. So
yeah, I think this is the kind of movie that I might wind up getting way too obsessed with.
Way too obsessed with. All right.
And I'll get into that in a minute, but,
Reactions. We'll go surface reactions.
This is a whole lot of movie. To me, like, this is sort of the culmination. I guess this is my first thought. And I was thinking this when I was watching it because I was noticing, cause I'm a big Aronofsky fan and have been since Pi. And Requiem for a Dream is one of the most evocative movies that I have ever seen in my entire life, as disturbing as it is. And I'm sitting there watching this movie, and obviously there's, you know, there's dramatic stuff going on, and I'm enjoying it and whatever, but I'm seeing all of these pieces of Aronofsky's career, and it all feels like it culminates in this movie. You have everything he's ever done, between the montaging and the psychological business and the violence, and all of this is all encapsulated in these 130 minutes, and I don't even know that I like the movie. Ah. I do.
Yeah.
I do. I know I do. But on a certain level, I don't know that I do because there's just so much going on in my head. And I don't know when the last time I was made to – that a movie made this happen to me.
Interesting.
Mulholland Drive, maybe, in 99 or whatever that was, David Lynch's next to last movie.
I think – so interesting. So for me – I loved it, and I think I've got a cleaner reaction to it than you did. You know, I just think it is a great movie, extremely entertaining.
Mm-hmm.
I think that it's like thematically provoking in a big way. And I think from the Bible angle, I thought you can't ask for a better Noah story than what he did. I just like that was a story. When I first heard about Noah, the movie coming out, I had very little interest because I hadn't really read the story in a while. And it was always just kind of like, okay, you know, old school Genesis story doesn't super grab me these days. But it was essentially like it was the Noah story I had no idea I wanted to see, if that makes sense. You know, much like The Dark Knight or something like that. You know, you don't know the potential of a movie when it's put in the hands of like someone who – is burning for this kind of material and is so skilled.
Right. Once I realized that this was not just an Aronofsky picture, but the Aronofsky picture, the thing that he's wanted to do. After I got home, I listened to an interview with him talking about it, and this whole obsession with Noah started when he was in middle school.
Interesting. Okay.
With a poem he wrote about the dove. And he's been obsessed with it ever since. And once I, you know, but I didn't know that at the time.
And this was the movie he gets to make because of the clout he built from his other smaller releases.
Yeah,
much.
Really, it was the acclaim of Black Swan.
Right.
Because The Wrestler was successful. The Fountain was a devastating failure. Requiem for a Dream was a cult picture that made some money, and Pi, nobody saw. It's just, you know, yeah. Nobody's going to watch it. It's black and white, and it's really weird. So really a lot of it's the wrestler Black Swan, and he gets to do his thing. Once I realized that this was his thing, I put myself on media blackout on it.
Oh, and speaking of that, I want to say, obviously, this will be filthy with spoilers, so continue.
Yes. Yeah, spoiler alert, there's some rain.
Yes.
I put myself on media blackout completely. No trailers, no pre-reviews, none of the commentary stuff that I often find myself getting stuck in with movies that I'm interested in seeing. That's really how badly I wanted to see this picture purely. And it was a good idea because not only does it get the straight biblical stuff right.
Right.
But, and I'm no expert in Judaic mysticism. But what I do know, there isn't very much in that movie that I can't pinpoint from somewhere in that world.
I mean, isn't that like the – like – so basically we know that Noah's like two or three chapters, right? I mean, it's – thematically it's quite rich, you know, deceivingly so. But narratively, there's not a ton to work with.
No,
right?
There's no drama in the story. God talks to Noah.
Right.
They build the ark, flood, error app.
That's right. Although we do get some insight into God as far as man is so wicked, right? So,
right.
You know, that's that thematic stuff. But as far as narrative, you get a sentence on the Nephilim, right? You know, you get a little bit of Noah getting plastered in the cave, right? You get his sons. So you're getting these small bits, but, you know, the rest. So basically what I found Aronofsky did is he was like true to this stuff and he just enhanced it with his imagination. Right.
Yeah, and a lot of the things that even seem enhanced, like the sort of what seems like it might even be ham-handed drama, the fight between the son of Seth, Noah,
right.
And the son of Cain, whatever his name is,
Tubal Cain,
who is played by
Ray Winstone.
Ray Winstone.
Yeah,
he's
like one. He's like X amount of generations down. Right?
Yeah. So, but that's that. Fight that war between those two families is in the mysticism.
And Tubal Cain is a real guy who is known for working with metalwork, so that's
right.
Biblical as well. You know,
it's all there. I mean, the Nephilim being enslaved by the sons of Cain, that's part of it.
Right.
It's all like when you think he's taking a liberty, he's actually pulling something from that world that's just massive and rich with craziness.
I mean, I have to say, like, as some, you know, I mean, I was just, like, I really felt, I mean, I don't know, it could, you know, you might have said, oh, you could have, like, ditched the rainbow. Like, he even took the rainbow and made it really awesome, right?
Yeah, the rainbow is awesome. The rainbow, that's what I'm, where I was talking about stuff from his, from his filmmaking past is that all that rainbow stuff and those, like, where, like, the souls of the Nephilim are heading up into heaven. That stuff's all from the fountain. Like, that's what he was trying to do in the fountain.
So it's like it was kind of bubbling there anyway, right?
Yeah, yeah. And he just made it happen here. And it was, like, when you got to that point and basically the final image of the movie is the image with a rainbow plastered over top of it.
Right, which you would think in lesser hand that would be a hokey last image.
It sounds
right?
Hokey, but it's beautiful.
And it's like a pulsating, and it's like what's fascinating about it, there's so much. I mean, we're going to try to keep this at half an hour, obviously.
Yeah,
but we could go on and on because there's, like, even when we're talking about Noah's relationship with the Creator, right, with God. I mean, it's, you know, it's visions, but he doesn't get really explicit stuff. You know, he's not getting explicit things, right?
Yeah,
but even though
so
that very, but I mean, that's the most explicit the Creator gets communicating with Noah is at the very end there with a pulsating rainbow, right?
But
which
it's
I
all
found
done
fascinating.
In imagery. It's all
yes.
Done through it's so there's the dramatic. So any screenwriting teacher or whatever, film school will tell you as a prospective filmmaker, show don't tell.
Right.
That's what God does with Noah.
Yes. Right. That's
show
right.
Don't tell. He shows Noah what to do and lets Noah interpret that in his own way.
In fact, I mean, that was a major theme, obviously, when especially when you compare him and Tubal Cain.
Yeah.
Just continue. He begs for the creator, right? He wants to know what's going on. I mean, he sees the Nephilim, so he knows there's a creator out there.
Right.
But he rages against them. One of the great lines. Again, precursor. If you are whatever faith that you follow that Noah is important to you, you know, Islam, Judaism, evangelical, whatever, like, this film, it treats it legit. You know, it is,
right.
It is not dumping on this stuff. In fact, there's some extraordinarily, like, I found profound stuff, especially when Tubal Cain in the Ark, it's a blink and you miss it line, but he said something about being ruled by heaven and man, you know, man ruling by his will, right?
Right. Yeah.
It's a real quick line, and I paraphrased it that, but it jumped out at me. It was like, well, there it is, right? That's like, that isn't, I mean, if you are a follower of this stuff, isn't that what it is, right?
Right.
There?
And, that's the decision you're having to make.
Right. And how, I mean, it's just
every second.
Absolutely. Which is why it's so perfectly articulated. And then how the payoff with Noah's, I mean, which, you know, obviously this, so, you know, this is where the artistic license comes out, where Noah is thinking, this will be the end of mankind, and if, you know, if my grandchildren are daughters, I'm going to kill them, right? So obviously that's, but I think that even makes sense in the context of what Aronofsky's doing. He's taking he's just taking that Noah story to this logical path.
Yeah, now I think that part, that whole, the infant side issue, is license. I don't think that comes
from
anywhere.
No, it doesn't. Right.
But what he's sort of doing, what Aronofsky's sort of doing in that, is placing the dramatic arc that God goes through in deciding to destroy his creation.
Right, I know where you're going.
Puts it into Noah's hands, which allows you, as the viewer, to actually have a dramatic, something to hold on to dramatically, because what you don't want is some scene, what I never would want to see, is some scene where you, like, flip up to heaven and God's sitting at a desk, like, making a list of pros and cons.
Right.
And it doesn't allow for that. It just takes it away from God, it doesn't take anything away from God in the movie. There's clearly a sense of as they say in the movie, the creator is paramount to this whole story, but they take all of the dramatic issues and place them into Noah's hands, and that allows us to have a handhold.
It makes sense. Like, it makes sense in the context. Like, what if you really sat down and thought what Noah had to do and the choice he had to make, and it's brought – again, this movie is great because it doesn't shy away from the hard stuff that is found in Noah and the Old Testament in general. Like, the screams of the people as they die. The people getting washed off on the –
That's a hard scene.
That's
man.
A hard scene. I mean, Shem, I think, says, let's drag a line. Those aren't all soldiers, you know? But
right.
That's an important line because he's not – this isn't like hokey Sunday school bearded God, right? This is like the hard stuff. And the logical extension of that is Noah understands that, and he had that vision, which I love that part where he goes into the depths of Cain's tribe there and just sees the depravity.
Oh,
right?
Yeah.
And he sees himself in that, and he just says, we are redeemless. We are without worth, right?
Well, and what's funny about that is that up until that point, Noah seems like he's the guy that he's sort of presented to be in the larger story, that he's the one piece of goodness in this world of depravity. But what it winds up being is instead of that, at that point he sees his own wickedness, and by proxy he sees the wickedness of his wife and his children and the girl that they pick up, and decides at that point he makes his choice because God's always allowing him to make the choice.
Right.
Once he sees that, he becomes this weirdly fatalistic antagonist.
He does, and it's very fascinating.
He becomes a monster.
Right.
You feel a certain level of hate in him for everything. And, you know, then he goes on and describes for everything that Noah's wife, played by Jennifer Connelly, is fantastic in the movie. She's giving each of their sons virtues, and he's responding with the analogous
this is where they can
sin.
Be. Which, again, is fascinating because, like, in lots of Christian thought, there's this idea of this kind of proportional. Like, human beings can be as evil as they want to be or as good as they want to be, right? You know, like,
right.
This is real quick, but, like, you know, like, Paul, example. He was, like, this persecutor of Christians forever, right?
Right.
And then he had this huge epiphany, and he took his talents and skills in the other direction. I think that's kind of a trend. That's something in thought. And I thought that was, like, wow. I mean, here is Darren Aronofsky, atheist, agnostic, whatever, getting at some really rich, like, legit theological stuff where Noah flips on that fulcrum, and then that leads us to that extraordinarily powerful moment, I thought, where he just leans over and kisses the children.
Yes, that scene and a couple of others were close to bringing me to tears.
I mean, really, I inhaled sharply. You know, it was like, wow. I mean,
I truly didn't know, even though I technically knew, but in the heat of the moment of the movie, I didn't truly know that he wasn't going to murder those children.
Sure.
And when the moment comes and he kisses them instead, like, you're seeing him make these choices, and he has the free agency. He could have just let it all die and have it be the Eden that he was describing previously. But
humans,
love
right? Minus over, humans.
Minus humans. But love overtook that.
Yeah.
Because humanity ultimately is worth saving.
Right. In fact, that's a callback to the conversation he had with, what's her face? I can't remember her name. I can't remember the actress. Emma Watson's
Emma
character.
Watson's, yeah.
You know, when they're talking briefly and, you know, he says, when we first took you in, I thought you were going to be a burden, right? Mm-hmm.
Yeah. You know,
but you're a gift. You're a precious gift. And there's the synergy to that. It's like, man, you know, holy cow, there it is right there. So,
yeah.
I mean, let's talk about the Nephilim, okay? Let's talk about the rock monsters because, you know, I will say, by and large, you know, the, religious type of reviews have really liked it, you know, but the negative ones have keyed in on this. Like, they have a problem with these rock monster things. And to me, I just thought it was fantastic.
Okay.
I thought it was just, I really enjoyed that idea of the fallen angels being enslaved by the world that they gave up for, you know?
Okay, so you've got the anybody who wants to pretend like the Nephilim, which are called the Watchers in the movie, which is proper, rather than trying to, like, give some weird explanation of this, like, really arcane part of the Bible and of Judaic mysticism.
Right.
They call them the Watchers so that you can just accept what they are. And I thought that was really smart, but anybody who thinks that this is not a real part of that world, you know, there's that big black field where they all live.
Right.
There is a freaking Swedish black metal band called Fields of Nephilim. because if there's anybody who knows Christian mysticism, it's Swedish black metal.
That's true. Absolutely.
But that's a thing. Like, those are real parts of, if you want to look for that stuff, those are real parts of it. And on the one hand, I was worried that it was going to be sort of a showpiece. Like, here's the scene where the Nephilim walk with the sons of Cain.
Right.
Because that's a thing. And it wasn't. They were actual characters.
They were.
And
it was
actual
really
characters
brilliant
with
how
names
the, everything
and
was,
stories.
Everything was cool, like why they fell. They fell out of sympathy. You know, they fell out of sympathy for humankind, right?
And then were betrayed.
And they were betrayed, but they were punished by God. So it's like, you know, this, you know, we're doing this out of love, but we're punished. But that's just the point. You can't, I mean, you're not, you can't rebel like that, right?
Right.
And
right.
then they were betrayed again. But then I loved how, so that's how they built the ark. I thought that was a cool thing, you know? How does this family build this giant ark? They got rock monsters helping. But
well, and
the big action scene, right, where all hell breaks loose. How awesome is that when they're doing that chain, right? Uh-huh. And then they just all of a sudden start. And then I just, like, I'm getting goosebumps just thinking about it, how the rocks break open and their spirits fly back up, right?
Well, here's the thing. Like, that's the beauty of this. Like, it's putting Noah and the Nephilim on the same level. Noah is redeeming humanity.
Right, yes.
Because the Nephilim redeem themselves.
That's right. And again, like, you know, above this all, you know, God is pulling these strings, right? But, like, these agents are acting on their own accord. right? So like, so, you know, this is, so obviously you bring in this, the free will stuff here, but like when they, you know, so here the Nephilim are sacrificing themselves, right? They're willfully sacrificing themselves on behalf of the humans who betrayed them in the first place, who really screwed them over. To the, and so just what a great, like, as far as like strict action movie making, how exciting was that?
It's
right?
Fantastic. It's
how
as
exciting
good as,
was that?
It's as good as anything, any action scene, and people have likened the Nephilim to the Transformers, which I think is lazy, but
yeah, right.
It's as good as any action scene in any of the Transformers movies, plus it has weight.
It has weight, absolutely. And like, the Nephilim are so wonderfully created that you could feel that they're enslaved in this rock, but underneath is this energy, right? And
yeah.
Then, and the design, like, they're very sympathetic and sad, pathetic creatures, almost,
yeah.
Right? And the way they yeah. walk, the way they, but just their payoff, even their little arcs are just fantastic. And I can't remember his name, but our main Nephilim guy, how he just completely sacrifices himself, right, at the end. I mean, just.
Yeah.
Fantastic stuff.
Yeah.
I just thought all hell breaking loose and you know, everyone's running around and it's raining and the spirits are there, explosion spirit up, and you know, it's just, it's super exciting.
Yeah, and now on a different note, you mentioned the rain. And that struck me as from a design standpoint, one of the greatest examples of sound design that I have ever experienced in a theater.
Interesting. Yeah, it was pretty good. We had
So I come from a very rainy place, up in the Pacific Northwest, and I've heard a lot of rain in my life. And eventually, rain becomes just noise that you no longer hear.
Right.
And when the rain started, about what was this? About halfway through the movie is when the rains come. It sounded. It was all over me that, Jesus, it's raining outside. And it was
like malicious rain.
Yeah,
right?
Hard, hard rain. And if you ever wanted to listen for it, and I did a few times just because I was so struck by it initially, if you ever want to listen for it, that rain sound never stops. But it becomes part of the background. And it just becomes white noise. But if you ever want to step back and say, oh, is that rain still there? It certainly is.
Yeah.
And along with every other little piece, the sound design, I would hope that this gets nominated for at least a sound design Oscar.
Right.
Because I'm not ordinarily super impressed with sound design, but holy cow, this thing was, I mean, it was just beautiful.
Well, again, just for the whole assault on the arc, everything going on.
Oh, yeah, everything going on.
It was just, I remember leaning over to my dad and just saying, like, this is pretty awesome. You know, I mean, like on a visceral level, it was awesome.
Yeah.
But like you said, everything had huge amounts of weight to it, you know. Moving on, the other thing we were talking about, and, you know, one of the other criticism level that is this going to be Al Gore's dream movie, right? Is this is this super environmentalism? Now, I will say, it was definitely, you know, like the curse, the corrupted land was front and center, for sure.
Yeah.
But I looked at it, and you could tell me what you thought. Like, I looked at it not as some missive by Aronofsky on biggie environmentalism. I found the corruption of the land an extension of the corruption of mankind.
Yeah.
Right? Like, I found, like, what they did to animals, what they did to the land and everything was, like, if they didn't show the stuff with them just being brutal to each other, like,
yeah.
If they didn't show that camp scene where people, the mass graves and people on the fences and they're ripping animals apart, I may have like said, okay, maybe, you know, what we got going on here, but it was pretty obvious. It was a total package. And
right.
Aronofsky, I think, was more interested in man's assault on the innocent, you know,
yes.
than like strip mining or, you know, carbon
right.
footprints
well,
or whatever. It was like man's outright assault on the innocent and their complete savagery. And it expanded out from that. And that, you know, so destruction of the environment was like destruction
that's
of animals.
That's part and parcel of it. What's more innocent than nature?
Right.
What, you know, how much, you know, and I'm not even going to get into different philosophies about animal free agency, but what has less free agency
right.
than nature? They work off of instinct and whereas we work off of free will. We, being the wicked in this movie,
yeah.
have made the choice to run a scorched earth policy.
Right.
That we're going to destroy everything, and then that's what
including each other.
Including ourselves. Each other, and that's where Tuva Cain says at a couple of different points, you know, we need to survive, and by God, if I'm not going to do everything I right. can to allow that. And that idea, that philosophy is what's caused the problems. It's not some Al Gore ideal. Environmentalism sort of comes part and parcel with kindness.
Yeah. So, like, and we had talked about this before, like, not, so it's like the little e environmentalism, not like a political movement or whatever, but the,
right.
you know, just like the basic decency, you know, the kindness, like you said, right? I mean, right. I let me return to my favorite whipping boy, Avatar, right? You know,
Avatar is very much big e environmentalism.
Absolutely. And like, and the story and characterization suffers on that, right? That was the message and everything else kind of feeds that, right? Whereas the scorched earth policy, like you mentioned, illuminates what Aronofsky's going for as far as mankind and the savagery and just the complete lost cause they turn themselves into, right? And again, look no further right. than that, like, startling scene in the camp when people are just eating their yeah. own, right? And they're, like, eating they're ripping animals apart.
Almost literally.
Yeah, literally, like, stomping on the young, stomping on the weak. I mean, Aronofsky made a point of showing that, dragging women out, dragging children, throwing children into the mass graves, right?
Right,
running over the kid while she's got the bear trap on her, right?
That was a hard scene.
That was
too,
a hard
man.
Scene, but again, like, that was an important scene for three characters: Tubal Cain, Noah,
absolutely.
And Ham.
And Ham, right? Yeah.
So, even though, again, one nitpick, if you were going to go, I mean, obviously in the story, all the sons are married and all that stuff, but I think it was important to set up that dramatic tension with Ham. I think that was
yeah.
important for sure.
Yeah. Yeah, and
in fact, it pays off. Like when he goes off to his own, that mirrors kind of biblical stuff too. But I mean, that's a small departure.
Yeah, you know, and I mean the fact though on when we're going back to that the city scene where Noah witnesses all of that, it's important that he doesn't try to save anybody.
Right.
These girls, he could easily go and take these girls.
As like he was getting right for. Like he was going to go find wives for the
right.
boys, right?
And there's the, you know, there could have been some scene where he buys the girls and then he yeah. frees them to marry his sons, which
right,
is,
right.
sounds like slavery in and of itself. But Aronofsky doesn't try to play it that way.
No.
When Noah sees that horror, the idea of him finding wives for his sons flies out the window.
That's
because
right.
they all deserve to die.
And he's made that decision there.
There's
nothing redeeming at all. So that's why he leaves that poor girl to, you know, that. But again, he's taking it to the logical conclusion.
Right.
You know, he's operating, like, really, Noah's operating very logically, even though he's taking directives from dreams and whatnot. You know, he's,
right.
like, he's a very practical, logical man from the beginning. You know, in their
right.
nomadic lifestyle, the way he raises his children, the way he raises his sons. You know, so he's very, the way he responds to the creator's, you know, instructions. It's all kind of very logical, so that's why it takes him to that end point of that's it. We're done with humanity.
Yeah.
So that moment of love, you know.
Until that, and it's so close to the end, it is before he gets way drunk in the cave,
which is very important. And like again, that's straight from the text, like
yeah.
word for word from the text, you know. So and they don't go into why he did it, but it's not hard to see, and it makes sense. Like, it makes sense in this film why he did it, you know?
And an interesting thing about that is there's this scene right before that where he finds this bunch of grapes in the brush. And it's the first thing – it's basically the first fruit that you've seen after the flood.
Right.
And on one level, it appears that, like – oh, well, maybe he's going to, like, bring this back and they're all going to enjoy grapes.
Yeah, right.
Nope. Turns it into wine, baby.
And again, like, I reread Noah, the Noah story again. They made it just, like, in a such a huge, monumental, history-shaping event that only gets, like, two or three chapters. They made a specific – like, we get a throwaway line about Nephilim roaming the earth, which would be like, yeah, can we get a little more of that maybe?
Right, but
we get, like – Noah grew this vineyard and he drank. And I mean, they really go into that, which kind of goes into what we had talked about. It's like he was a flawed man picked to do something amazing, right?
Yeah.
And I think, which is critical.
And he was up to the challenge because as I don't remember who was Emma Watson or Jennifer Connelly's character, but who says that he was chosen because he could be shown the wickedness of man and not look away.
Yeah, that's a great line. It may have been Emma Watson at that very last.
I think it was.
That last conversation, you know, that conversation.
And that's important. It's not that you're better than man. It's not that you're the best man.
Right.
Or that you're the most virtuous man. It's that you won't deny the truth of man.
Right.
And when you – that's, I think, important to sort of the both the way that it happens with the Canaanites – not the Canaanites specifically, but, you right. know, the sons of Cain.
Yeah.
And with how certain people are reacting to the movie, that at a certain point, if you don't look at what's going on with humanity, then you are complicit in the problem.
And isn't that, again, I'm going to let you flash back to your Lutheran roots, but I mean, isn't that kind of the crux of the big gospel payoffs towards the end, right? Like the realization right. of your flaws, the realization, you know, why is pride the number one sin? You know, that kind of that coming face to face. And I think that's why you see in Noah's story, in David's story, so on and so forth, special attention given to the major flaws that these people have, right?
Yeah.
Moses, go on down the line, the major flaws. A couple other leftovers before we wrap this up. Like I loved the costume design. It was like surprisingly modern. Right? And it kind of was cool. It was like, because we forget, these guys were living like 800, 900 years, right?
Right.
So 8 generations from Adam is a decent amount of time.
Right.
You know, so like, you can see there's advancements that can be made within that time frame. So I kind of liked how, you know, they weren't like, it wasn't just loincloths and, you know, bear skins. It was backpacks and hoodies.
Clothes. Yeah,
and
yeah.
Clothes, you know, and plate mail. So it felt like they lived. It felt like human beings actually lived a stretch, you know, a whole stretch of their existence. And then God hit the hard reset because it was so bad.
Right. And then we had to come back from square one.
Which was like, and you don't think about that usually because Noah happens like 4 chapters in Genesis. So you don't really think about that. But if you really looked at the years, I mean, you're talking about hundreds of years here. So it's almost like a miniature, you know, they had a mini time on Earth and it got so bad. It was like, you know. God, I had second thoughts about it. So I thought that was really cool.
Well, and they make a point at the very beginning, and I think it's important to listen closely to the opening.
The genealogy?
Yeah, well, not the genealogy, but the idea that they built a great industrial society. And the point is they made this great industrial society. It wasn't just like, you know, a bunch of people living together. They had machines and industry and likely an economic system. They had a complete society.
Right. And again, that's great. That's a good point. So, and I was thinking similar to that, not like they made this industrial society like we have with all of our pollution and blah, blah, blah. Again, no, it was they developed a civilization that got so off the rails, you know, creation itself paid the price for it.
Well, they became so fond of man.
True.
They became great
so point.
Fond of their own will.
That's a great
that
point.
They didn't forget God, but God's because they felt like God stopped talking to them.
Yeah.
That then it was just up to them to be, I would say, stewards.
Yes.
But Tuva Cain says subduers.
Subduers, right?
Of nature.
Great point.
And so that's sort of the problem where Noah is the steward, as Adam was initially. Hired to do, built to do.
That's right. And can we just say, like, how cool was that not the coolest depiction of, like, the creation narrative you've ever seen on film?
What's really cool is that what it reminds me of is the old, and this is actually replayed on Cosmos, not this past week, but the week before, Carl Sagan's old 30-second line drawing of evolution from single cell to man.
Right.
And it was basically a three-dimensional version of that from the point of nothingness. And my heart almost stopped when he closed the light and it went to blackness.
Yeah.
And he starts talking about blackness.
Right.
It was so – that's such a strong opening to that scene. And then, yeah, it goes in this fast-motion, ultra-fast-motion montage
right.
of from the Big Bang – through to where they are at that point in history.
And very fascinating how Adam and Eve are like almost these pseudo-angelic beings. Right?
Yeah, they don't even – he doesn't even try to – he doesn't cast them as actors. They're just lights. They're just human-shaped lights. They're a symbol. And that's what they were supposed to – that it's that symbol that they were supposed to emulate.
Right, right.
And they failed.
Absolutely. And again, what was the one scene we see – some really powerful – like, what scene do we see over and over again more than anything? I think, like, the serpent, which is great, the fruit, and then Cain killing Abel, right?
Yeah, it's Aronofsky's old hip-hop montage from Requiem for a Dream, where he repeats a series of pieces to punctuate things. And then, in this case, it was serpent,
apple,
hand-grabbing the apple.
Right.
And then that hand grabbing the apple turns – that apple turns into a rock.
Which Cain uses.
And then that's Cain braining a
– right, which is about as succinct –
and that's the start of – that's the beginning of the end.
Which is about as succinct as – in fact, I love how – you know, I love how they – the Cain and Abel, those silhouettes, you know, blow out into, like, modern people killing each other, right?
Yeah,
and,
yeah.
So just, again – like, if you're – again, so if you're coming at this from a biblical point of view, you know – I mean, this is your life. This is your worldview. I just can't imagine. I just don't know how you can have any problem with this. I'll just put it that way.
There's a certain group of people who want it candy coated.
You're correct. I mean, that's right. I mean, you're exact. So you're right. So then that's when your Kirk Cameron type of movies are for you, right? But if you were like literally very, if you were honestly interested in the story getting out to people and people actually being interested in the religion that you pursue, the lifestyle you pursue, isn't this the type of movie that will have a lot more pull than something only the choir is going to see, right? I mean, and like, you're telling me someone who doesn't know anything about anything but likes this movie wouldn't be at least interested in just taking a look at Genesis, see all the kind of crazy stuff going on? I don't know.
Right.
There's
plenty more crazy stuff going on. Now I want to see a movie about Abraham having an existential crisis about his God forcing him to kill his son.
I mean, people
only to come back and say April Fools.
That's the only rock. That's what the rock monster critics don't understand. Like, the Old Testament is bananas, man.
Yes, it's totally bananas.
I mean, it was like Lord of the Rings legit back there. I mean, you had columns of fire and like who knows what else was going on.
Giants,
leviathans, you know, angels of death, plagues,
babies being brained on rocks.
I mean, it was like
it's insane.
It is not a whitewashable
history. Pretty picture.
That's right. Which is the whole point, obviously.
The whole point, yeah. And I think if people would be better off, not just for enjoying Noah, but for really understanding their own faith.
Yes.
That this isn't, and this coming from somebody who doesn't have a lot of it, so.
Right.
You know,
But you're obviously familiar.
Super familiar with the stuff.
Yes.
I've spent many a long time dealing with these things and reckoning with these things. But if people would just take sort of the reality of what's going on in this and reckon with it, then they'll get more satisfaction out of the redemption that happens in the New Testament.
Absolutely. I mean, well stated. Absolutely. I mean, I just – like, this is the stuff I want. Like, give me this hard stuff. I mean, because that's what it is. Like, I mean, I – If JC was here and you asked him, you know, what do you want to see? Like, someone employing the arts and talents that they have been endowed with into grappling with this stuff, or just kind of churning out, taking a love offering and churning out some innocuous twaddle that isn't going to move the needle at all, right? Give me this.
Absolutely.
Like 10 times out of 10.
Yeah, and not to overstate the point, but the whole point of the Noah story is Noah reckoning with his own faith.
Correct.
And Abraham is reckoning with his own faith. Even Jesus reckons with his own
faith.
Right,
absolutely. Right.
And this is the kind of movie – Noah is the kind of movie that even as somebody who's decidedly not Christian, I still reckon with my own faith watching it.
Right. Which is there a higher compliment you can pay?
Right, because
for an
these
artist?
Are things that are real. Because existential crises are real things.
Right. Yes.
And to deny them, to look away from them, and just you know shrug your shoulders and say, it'll be better tomorrow, or the super pat response, the Lord works in mysterious ways.
Absolutely. Both are shallow and insignificant.
And totally unhelpful.
Yes, totally unhelpful.
And especially at the times that you need the most, you know, why did my son die?
Right, right.
Well, the Lord works in mysterious
ways.
That
doesn't cut it. That doesn't cut it.
F you.
That's right. That doesn't cut it. Absolutely.
That's not helpful.
I couldn't agree with you more. Absolutely.
And, you know, more than anything, when things like that happen, reckon with your faith and with your spirituality and with your history and with everything and figure it out. And we have this free will to figure it out. And
everybody in Noah has an existential crisis. No one does not have
it. It's a 135-minute existential
crisis.
That's
right. I mean, everyone is and everyone deals with it their own, whether it's two
outside of Noah, or
the rock monsters, right?
Yeah. The only one who doesn't seem to really have an existential crisis is Methuselah.
Methuselah, right.
Who's hilariously played by Anthony Hopkins.
Absolutely.
And I actually laughed in the movie when he kept talking about berries.
Berries, right.
Cracked me up because he's the one. He was so old, he didn't care. But everybody else has to reckon with this, and so do we. So that's where this movie is really powerful to me, and where I really – it's a lot of movie because it's a whole hell of a lot to chew on. It's a whole lot more to chew on than any movie I've seen in some time.
I think so. And as an added bonus, it is hugely entertaining to watch.
Yes. Very action-packed.
Action-packed. And hugely entertaining. Like, I just love all the little things, like how the animals showed up, how they put it in the
scale. Remember scale dog? The dog that the hunters get? It's all covered in scales?
Oh, yeah, right, the scale dog. But I love that. All that imagination, or just how all the animals went, you know. So, like, how do they gather all these animals? Well, they just showed up, right? Because that, you know, that Eden seed kind of spread out the word, essentially, right? I mean, what a great scene, the two birds kind of flying
over. Oh, that was a beautiful scene.
It's a beautiful scene. Or just how did you get all these animals to hang out in the ark? Let's just have them cook up some sedatives.
Great. Yeah,
you know, it's great. That's great. It's like, well, but again, that's not the point. Again, that's not what he's worried about. So
it's just getting us through scenes and the overall picture. And as I said on the filibuster last week, Aronofsky is a guy that deals with big picture issues. He does big. And this is the definition of big.
It is. You're absolutely right. It is very big, but the themes are extraordinarily personal too.
Yes.
And I will say, my only criticism for Aronofsky is when I guess, and maybe this quote's out of context. He had said something along the lines of, "This is the least biblical movie ever made." Or I'm not sure what he meant by "least Bible." I'm not sure. Do you remember that quote?
I don't remember the quote.
I'm going to look back at it because I'm probably doing a disservice, because I find it easily, like hands down, this was the greatest Bible movie I've ever seen.
Well, maybe what he meant, and I'm obviously would be speaking for him, and I don't mean that, but maybe what he meant is that it's the least, or it's not very reverential. It's accurate, but it doesn't treat the material as sacred. It treats it as drama.
I guess. I'm going to take the point of view that maybe compared to other Bible movies, it's not the kind of – it's not your dad's Bible movie. Maybe.
It's not your daddy's Bible movie.
So, like – because I did find it extraordinary. Like, as far as – I found it reverential because I don't any license made sense to me. And, like, the creator was the creator. I mean, there was no doubt. Like, Noah wasn't crazy. He wasn't hallucinating this.
No.
You know?
Yeah.
The creator was a creator. So I found it reverential. But I think it's not your granddad's – you know, yeah, Bible movie. You know,
yeah,
this isn't your Charlton Heston
story
movie
ever told.
That's right. Absolutely. This is, I mean, like even, and again, I'd laugh at people who like maybe make fun of the rock monsters or whatnot. I mean, Mel Gibson took artistic liberties in Passion of the Christ, which is, you know, well revered. A movie I liked, but I find this to be far more thematically satisfying. But guess what? Gibson had like demons running around in his film there too, so.
Right, yeah, you know, nobody complained about that.
So let's just kind of like let artists kind of do their work. You know,
let artists be artists.
Yes.
And if there's one working filmmaking artist that I respect more than anyone else right now, as far as their skill and their ability to make genuine beauty. It's Darren Aronofsky.
Well put. I think we can wrap that up. Just so, again, I guess we don't need to tie anything up nice. We both enjoy the movie a great deal.
It's awesome.
It is awesome. It's a great experience. I think it's something I'm going to keep thinking about and wanting to see more of. But just, it exceeded my expectations. Any skepticism I had about whatever, you know, went out the window. You know, give it a watch, whatever side you may fall on. You know, wherever – it really is something – has got something for everybody, right?
Yeah, and I mean – and I think that listeners really should take note that Dave and I are so much on the same page about this movie when we're so much not on the same page about our spirituality.
That's right.
And I think that's really important to the universality of this, of the story that's being told and the power of the filmmaking involved.
Agreed.
It doesn't make me, I don't sit there and pretend, as a horror movie fan, I can't sit there and, oh, this doesn't make logical sense.
Right.
Well, neither does Pinhead. So for Dave, who is very much a Christian, and for myself, who is very much not, this movie appears to have equal value and equal power. And for Aronofsky to be able to do that, man.
That's a win. Right?
That's a serious win.
Let's get him over to broker some Palestinian-Israeli accords. Maybe that's
no kidding.
No, for sure.
Here, man.
Absolutely. But again, though, I would say, too, to our credit, I'm going to pat ourselves. Like, I don't think we are – you know, I think some people will set up – They will dig in their trenches and they will fight, you know, they will fight the fight no matter what, you know. So like they will be so ruled by whatever preconceived notions or biases they have that they won't give it a chance. Or they'll find, you know, they'll have these problems like, oh, that's not biblical. So it's, you know, of the devil or whatever. Or it's like, oh, that's a stupid fairy tale and how are they going to get all those animals and blah, blah, blah. You know, so I think it's also good. I think it's good to have these conversations anyway, not be like, so obstinate as well. So I think if you go in like show me what you got, Aronofsky, right? Like,
right.
Let me just see what you're dealing with. Let me see your immense talent put to the test. I can't see how you don't leave that theater just floored. So.
Yeah.
But yeah, but you put it more succinctly, so I'm going to let you, yeah. What Daryl said, how about that? I'll just say that. So anyway, great movie, awesome stuff. I'm so glad, just like I'm glad it got made, and I hope more. It sounds like it's doing pretty well. I hope more studios take a chance. I hope more artists really, you know, treat this stuff genuinely and grapple with this and give us stuff like this, because this, I think this advances these conversations a whole lot more than stuff on either end. You know, right? Whether it's
right.
You know, Fireproof or Bill Maher's documentary, or whatever. You know, like to me, this right, this.
Tolerable.
This advances that conversation a lot.
Easy. Right.
So, all right. I think that's it. I think we probably could have gone on and on. We'll probably clean up any last thoughts on the next Friday filibuster. But that's it. Please go see the movie. It's badass. It's badass, right?
There's no question.
At the very least,
badass.
It is badass.
The effects are amazing.
Yes.
The filmmaking is beautiful. The performances are great. Jennifer Connelly is hands down the best crier.
Yes.
Working in movies today.
An excellent crier. It looks awesome. It's just beautiful.
It's brilliant all the way around. I could quibble about a few things about pacing and junk.
Sure.
But you know what? In a movie that has 40 days and 40 nights, you've got to have 40 days
you
and
got,
40
that's
nights
right.
at a certain level.
That's right.
That does not pass fast.
That's right.
So
no.
Does it feel a little long? Maybe. But the Clint Mansell's music is amazing. The song, the lullaby written by Patti Smith.
Yeah, nice.
Is beautiful. It's just
– and the payoff is worth it.
The payoff is worth it. The whole thing is worth it. Seeing the Nephilim walking the earth is worth it. Wow. I've never seen that in a movie before.
That's right.
I've seen all kinds of crazy crap in movies
I've never seen that. Yeah.
So if you're just looking for something you've never seen before, it's going to have that. It has – I mean, I'm not saying it's the greatest movie I've ever seen, but I couldn't be more excited about it.
I think it exceeded our lofty expectations.
Yes,
by a good
absolutely.
Margin.
Absolutely.
By like 30 qubits, if you will.
Yes,
so,
at least 30 qubits.
At least 30 qubits worth. So, all right, so we'll wrap this up. Thanks for listening. Really go see the movie. We'll see you at the next Friday Filibuster. Daryl, good times. Talk to you later, man.
Talk to you soon.